Welcome back to the Sustainability Report. My name is Louise Santa Cruz, and joining me today are two of my colleagues, Julie Santoro and Nick Bergmeier. And while I always enjoy talking about sustainability reporting, given I'm an auditor, I love it when it intersects with financial statement accounting. And so I'm looking forward today to pivoting to our topic. But before I start, I did want to mention that we originally planned to talk about California climate rules, but obviously, given the tragic situation with the wildfires in California, we thought we would hold that topic right now because we know a lot of people listening are likely impacted and we're thinking of them. So we're going to talk about something else today. We're actually going to talk about a proposed ASU that came out last month from the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB, on accounting for environmental credits and environmental credit obligations. And this is a topic that standard setters have been talking about for decades, about how to account for the assets and liabilities associated with some of these emission schemes. Like, you may know them as cap and trade schemes, and they exist globally. And to add to that, more and more companies are acquiring or generating credits like RECs and RINs, you may have heard of, so they can buy or sell them, or they can use them to offset their own emissions to meet their own voluntary reductions or net zero targets. And in response to an agenda consultation a few years ago, stakeholders asked the FASB to provide some guidance. And this is the result of that work. We've been following this project, I think, Nixon, since inception in May 2022, when they started talking about it. To date, companies have been analogizing to existing guidance for inventory and intangibles, or some maybe have just been expensing the costs as incurred. And there's a lot of diversity in practice, which is what this standard is looking to address. I think the call to action today is to give you some insights about the proposal. So perhaps you'd consider commenting to the FASB by April 15th, which is their comment letter deadline, if this accounting standard, this proposal, would have an impact on your existing accounting. So stay tuned as we unpack this complex but crucial topic. Julie, maybe you could set the stage for this discussion by defining exactly what we're talking about by environmental credits and maybe highlight a few of the schemes that U.S. companies might comply with.
Sure, Louise, and thank you for inviting me here today. But before we even get to the proposal, this is what we talk about in the universe of sustainability reporting. So the FASB is using environmental credit as a kind of a catch-all. In practice, we use a variety of terms, carbon credits, offsets, offset credits, allowances, certificates, really things that companies acquire or generate or granted by a regulator. Typically, I always say carbon credits. And what is that? Well, it represents the removal or reduction or the avoidance of carbon emissions from a specific project. And that's used to offset emissions that occur elsewhere. And these could be purchased because they're used to meet a voluntary target or goal, or it could be a mandatory requirement.
Yeah, Julie, I would just jump in and point out that, I mean, these are really becoming more and more prevalent as years go by. And with that, the accounting is becoming more and more material to companies. And currently, the lack of accounting guidance is causing, you know, significant diversity in practice, which has ended up being an issue for our stakeholders.
Yeah, totally, Nick. I could give you some examples. So again, if we ignore the proposal itself, there is just a huge population of laws, regulations, and other arrangements. So we start with the most obvious. Louise mentioned this at the beginning, emissions allowances from cap and trade schemes. So these programs set a cap on the total amount of carbon emissions by certain companies. Those companies must hold allowances equal to their emissions, and they could trade allowances with other companies. So other US examples are renewable energy certificates or RECs and renewable identification numbers or RINs. And we're talking about US GAAP, But even for US companies, we have to think about this more globally. So the most common international cap and trade scheme that our listeners will have heard of is the EU's emissions trading system, the EU ETS, with obligations for excess emissions settled in allowances that are traded. But I got to point out that there are just new laws and regulations popping up all the time. So a good example is CBAM. That's recent. That's the EU's carbon border adjustment mechanism. It's a carbon tariff on certain goods imported into the EU that is settled by allowances purchased by the importer. Louise, as you know, we talk frequently with our international colleagues on emissions trading schemes, and the list, frankly, just goes on. All of them with different terms and conditions. Just the other day, we were discussing guarantees of origin in the EU. And it's not just the official laws and regulations in countries. There is an absolute proliferation of voluntary initiatives, often used to meet voluntary sustainability goals. So bottom line, it's a really wild landscape right now.
Yeah, Julie, Nick, and I have been on a lot of conversations, and there are just so many schemes right now. Actually, Nick, maybe before we start talking about the proposed accounting model, you can build on what Julie said and talk more specifically about how environmental credits are defined in the proposal, because there are so many schemes, especially as Julie was talking about coming out of Europe, that are impacting US companies. So are all of these environmental credits in scope, RECs, RINs, but there's so many others. Some I know have various restrictions, like you can't sell them or transfer them to third parties. So how will this work?
Well, let me start just by saying that I think one of the challenges in evaluating the FASB proposal here is that there just are so many different schemes, all with their own, like you said, rules and regulations and various attributes of the credits that you need to evaluate each one of those separately. So we've been really focused on just trying to understand how all those different programs fit into the guidance, and you know, would encourage anybody who's reporting under US GAAP to kind of do the same thing to see how this proposal would affect them. But maybe, you know, just kind of starting with what's in scope, I'll start with the asset side, or really the environmental credit itself. So in order for an environmental credit to be in scope, the FASB has provided a definition or proposed a definition. And let me give you sort of the highlights of that definition of an environmental credit. It's an enforceable right that could be acquired, internally generated, could be granted by a regulatory agency, or even received in a non-reciprocal transfer. Okay, so that's how you might acquire the credit. But then it needs to meet certain criteria. There's four of them. One, it lacks physical substance and is not a financial asset. Two, it's represented to prevent, control, reduce, or remove emissions or other pollution. Three, it's separately transferable in an exchange transaction. And then four, it's not an income tax credit. Okay, let me emphasize that last one a bit, because I know there's a lot of income tax credits that can be generated by, you know, producing clean energy or something like that. And those are pretty prevalent. Those are not in scope, would be continued to be accounted for under other GAAP. And looking at that definition, right, there's a couple of those criteria that certainly could be judgmental and difficult to evaluate in certain circumstances. So that's where we first spend a lot of time just making sure we're actually in scope each time we talk about a certain type of credit.
Okay, thanks, Nick. And maybe on the other side, what are some of the obligations that are in scope? So you mentioned other GAAP. So if a company commits to retrofitting their equipment as part of a net zero transition plan, is that obligation or potential obligation in scope, or environmental remediation obligations, are they now in scope of this proposed standard?
No, for those types of things, GAAP, you know, really isn't changing. So the type of programs that are being scoped in here are what are defined as environmental credit obligations or liabilities relating to those. And those arise from compliance programs. So it's got to be by a law, regulation, or other, you know, legal scheme. And the other key portion of that definition is that the obligation can be settled in environmental credits, right? So the other things that you sort of mentioned there, Louise, there's other GAAP that would address those currently and wouldn't be changing, such as the guidance on asset retirement obligations or loss contingencies to address those environmental remediations. Now, you know, I think one of the themes throughout this proposal by the FASB is that the asset or the credit side is really driving everything. And as I mentioned here, that part to, for the liability to be in scope, it's got to be settled in an environmental credit. And that environmental credit has to meet the definition we talked about before on of an environmental credit. So everything is a little bit circular within the proposal.
Okay, so Nick, let's build on scope. Let's say an environmental credit is in scope. How is a company going to account for that credit under the proposal? I know we're referring to this asset recognition model as intent-based. So what does that mean?
Yeah, and why we say that is because we've been sort of referring to it as intent-based is because the FASB has decided that how the entity is going to use the credit sort of determines whether or not it qualifies as an asset to that entity. So let me give you sort of the criteria here. So under the proposal, an environmental credit would be recognized as an asset if it's probable the credit's going to be used to either settle an environmental credit obligation or transfer to another party in exchange transactions. So right there, that's, again, viewing the probability of how the company is going to actually use the credit in one of those two ways. Now, the cost of all other credits then are expensed as incurred. So if you're purchasing something and it's to just offset your own voluntary reporting, those are generally have been referred to as voluntary credits, and they're not going to be used to settle an ECO obligation or to be sold. So those sorts of arrangements, even though the credit's exactly the same as maybe somebody else who's going to use it for a different purpose, would be expensed based on your intent.
Let's go back to your point about the various uses that a company may have for a credit. For the credits that will be capitalized under this model, how are they going to be classified?
So the next thing about when the credits, if they qualify as assets, they are initially measured at cost, right? And how you determine that even depends on how you got the credits. So if the credits are internally generated, the only cost that you would measure those assets at are sort of incremental transaction costs. For example, cost to register them on a registry. So that means really no allocation of sort of in other internal costs that maybe collectively were used or part of the generation of those credits. Now, for some companies that internally generate those credits and then sell them, that certainly could lead to a mismatch between when they incur the costs and then when they sell them, because you're going to recognize the income when you meet the criteria to recognize those on sale. So again, a little bit different model or inconsistency based on if you just acquire them, it's purely at cost. And if you internally generate them, there's going to be less cost that would be attributable to them.
Okay. So as I'm understanding it, you're either going to capitalize them if you're going to use them to settle an environmental credit obligation, or you're going to sell or transfer them. And so for those credits that you are capitalizing, are you classifying them as inventory or intangibles, or how would they be classified?
I mean, they're not really either, right? Like, I mean, this new proposal is kind of creating a whole separate type of asset. So currently under GAAP, you look at, or companies are analogizing to either inventory or intangible assets in order to do their accounting. And this model is getting rid of that, and it's going to be an environmental credit. Now, we talked about intent. And that is important not only to whether or not the credit qualifies as an asset, but it's also important to the ongoing accounting, because that credit's a compliance credit. So you have an asset, and it's now you determine that's a compliance credit because it's probable it's going to be used to settle an ECO liability. Well, that asset stays on your books at cost and is not remeasured. Now, if it's a non-compliance credit, which would mean that, you know, it's not probable you're going to use it to settle an ECO. So that would mean you're probably going to be selling it or exchanging it. That asset's actually subject to impairment. So when fair value goes below cost, you're going to take an impairment. This assessment of the type of credit is ongoing. So every reporting period, you'll have to assess as a compliance or non-compliance, and you could reclass between. But one important thing to note that if costs are expensed either upfront or later on because of an impairment, you don't reverse any of the expense that you've taken, even if you reclass the type of asset.
So does the company have any ability to fair value these credits? What if you're just in the business of trading and selling credits? Isn't fair value make more sense to investors, or do you have to always measure them at cost?
No, that's a good question, because in the FASB had the same question, right? And they said, so they decided that if that was sort of your business, they wanted to give people the option. So you can elect to apply the fair value option to eligible classes of non-compliance credits. Eligible classes would mean that they've credits that you, one, you purchase and they're non-compliant. So if you internally generate them, you cannot apply the fair value option. Again, and that's got to be, you know, sort of applied to a certain portfolio or class of credits.
What about on the ECO liability side? I know there's diversity in practice, and from talking to companies, a lot of them just look at the liability as what they may owe to the regulator above the credits they already have on hand to remit. And so they're calculating a net liability. But this proposal has this concept of funded and unfunded portions of the liability. So can you explain a little bit about what companies will be doing to calculate the ECO liability? It sounds like it may be a little trickier to calculate than at first appears. Peers, because going back to what you said in the beginning, it's driven off of the asset side, the measurement.
First thing you do is at the balance sheet date, you look at your compliance program and you need to calculate, if it ended today, how many credits would I need to submit to satisfy that obligation, all right? But as we mentioned before, the next step, you really got to go back to the asset side. And the asset side, to make sure you got your compliance credits and non-compliance credits and all that stuff sorted out. Because once you figure out how many credits you need, the liability is measured first based on the funded amount. And the funded amount is the compliance credits you have on hand that would be used to settle the obligation. So say I want to submit 100 credits. I have 50 on hand. So the 50 would be my funded portion of the liability, and I would use whatever the carrying amount of my balance sheet is of those compliance credits. Now, next, because I still have 50 credits I need to submit that I don't have on hand, now I got an unfunded portion, and I need to find a way to measure that. And the FASB has said fair value. So you use fair value. So basically, what would it cost me to acquire those credits today to satisfy the unfunded portion of the liability. Now, obviously, if you have unfunded amounts, when you go from period to period to period, that could change, as well as even the number of credits that you might owe. So each time you have a change to your ECO liability that's recognized, those changes are going to end up going through the income statement. So there could be some fluctuations there depending on how the values change, and as well as just your obligation changing.
Nick, I think it's really interesting that carbon credits purchased voluntarily to meet emissions reduction goals. So they don't meet, they're not an obligation. Those are expensed as incurred. Do we know why the FASB made that decision?
Well, you know, listening to the meetings, you know, some of the board members really liken the purchase of those credits as either a charitable contribution or even a marketing expense. So I think that really just influenced, you know, at least how some of them interpreted the definition of an asset in their concept statement, thinking that there's really not future economic benefit to that specific entity for the credits.
I'm interested in the feedback that the FASB is going to get on that point. Julie, so you spent a lot of time looking at GHG emissions. We've got a handbook on it. How can companies leverage what they're already doing around sustainability accounting on GHG emissions with this new accounting requirement? Is there like a connectivity and interoperability with their sustainability reporting?
Yeah, well, I think that while the financial accounting doesn't have a direct impact on GHG emissions reporting, there is a nexus, or connectivity, as we now like to say. We've heard Nick explain about the proposed kind of intent-based accounting and the distinction between compliance and non-compliance credits. If we look at sustainability reporting, GHG emissions are reported gross, so before any carbon credits, etc., except for market-based scope 2 emissions. And we're not going down that rabbit hole today, Louise. But many companies disclose details about how their emissions have been reduced through the purchase and retirement of carbon credits. And sometimes that disclosure is on a voluntary basis in their sustainability report. And sometimes it's required. So for example, companies looking at the EU standards, the ESRSs. So the messaging, to my mind, with an intent-based accounting, the messages in the sustainability reporting will need to line up with the accounting, of course, subject to materiality, because I think it's going to be fairly easy to see if there's a disconnect.
You're saying that they really have to make sure to tell a consistent story, even though the frameworks for reporting are completely different. And that's a really important point. This is probably a question to both of you, but do you think that this proposal could have a significant impact on how companies are currently accounting for these credits? From conversations we've been having with companies, do you have any initial reactions on their concerns around how this model could be difficult to implement or maybe not tell the story they want to tell? And part of this conversation may be to help our listeners understand whether they may want to comment on some of the impacts by the April 15th deadline.
I think it will change practice for some companies, not every company. We talked to a lot of companies where it's not going to change really anything, and others that where it will have a much bigger impact. I mean, I think one of the things where it could change practice for companies that are capitalizing internal costs related to generating credits, it certainly would be a difference for them. I guess some of the other feedback that we've heard about is just acknowledging that different holders of the same credit would get a different answer in terms of whether or not they could record an asset and sort of the inconsistencies there from reporting entity to reporting entity, just based on, you know, the judgment around probability of how that asset could be used. I mean, there's a lot of questions that we're getting, but I mean, I think those are a couple of the highlights. Well,
one of my big questions is the lack of clarity about where the debit goes when booking the liability. My immediate thought was that it could be capitalized into inventory or PP&E as appropriate, like we do for other costs incurred. It's not 100% clear to me, but it seems that the debit would go to P&L. Is there a reason why this is different from general asset measurement principles on initial recognition or even ARO accounting? I think that's worth thinking about.
Julie, how can companies leverage what they're doing now on their GHG emissions? So I'm thinking operationalizing this accounting standard. Is there anything they can do now or think about to help them?
Thank you for asking that question. I really love it because my answer is the same as what I recommend for finance departments right now. I see three immediate steps, and the FASB's ASU, the proposed ASU, makes this task more urgent. So from my perspective, number one, go and visit your sustainability team. Find out, if you do not know already, find out what credits or allowances are being purchased and why. It's also a great opportunity to make sure you're aware of what laws and regulations you are subject to or maybe in the future. And a top tip, many companies are already subject to California's law on carbon offsets, AB 1305, and that requires detailed disclosures about credits and the underlying projects. Take a look at those disclosures or plan disclosures and find out if you have a CDP response. So CDP was previously called Carbon Disclosure Project. Many, many companies submit a questionnaire. Take a look at those disclosures. So that's number one. Number two, and Nick made this point, take a really good look at the scope of the proposals and see if you're in the scope to start with. We're having conversations where we include ourselves. We get quite far along before we realize, hey, is this really kind of in scope?
Is it transferable?
Exactly. Yes. Start there. And number three, to the extent you are in scope, understand how that would change your accounting. For example, are you capitalizing what would be non-compliance credits that would have to be expensed under the proposal? And if I come back to my earlier point, look at what your company is already disclosing about carbon credits. That could well go to intent. So three steps.
Thanks, Julie. Nick, there's a lot we didn't get to today on the proposal. I know we didn't get to talk about transition or all the disclosures. And actually, for some companies, disclosures, I think you were saying that the proposal itself may not impact their accounting so much, but the robust disclosures may be something that they want to look at. But luckily, our listeners can read our defining issues that can be found on KPMG's Financial Reporting View website. But do you have any parting thoughts about why companies should comment on this proposal and how do they go about doing it, especially for companies that may not have done it before?
I think it's always a good idea to consider the proposals. And then if they do impact you and you have some information you can share with the FASB is always looking for feedback, right? The better the feedback that they get, the better end standard and end product that they're going to provide to the capital markets. So everybody's feedback is really a critical part of the standard setting process. In order to do it, you can look at the proposal. They give instructions on where to submit the letter and just go answer the questions, or some people just write a cover letter giving their high level feedback. So there's a lot of ways to do it. And you could always just go to the FASB's website and see samples of other comment letters that people have done.
Because they're publicly available.
They are public.
Yeah, I could just reiterate that because I know there's got a lot of people listening who think, hey, why bother? Nobody's going to listen. And, you know, I was in last December at the AICPA and CIMA conference on kind of SEC and other developments. And FASB Chair Rich Jones, in his address, I mean, they went through kind of and showed empirically how they have kind of adjusted or pivoted based on the feedback they've received. If you don't ask, you'll never get.
Thanks to my brilliant colleagues, Julie and Nick, for joining me today on the Sustainability Report. If this proposal impacts your company, I really encourage you to read it and comment on it by April 15th. Don't miss any future financial reporting episodes. Subscribe now on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll tune in again for the Sustainability Report.